So let me just say welcome. Thanks for coming. This is John Miller, Reverend John Miller, who is a pastor in Ephrata and the administrative vice president of the Warshersburg Society, which, as I told my church history class this morning, means he does all the work. And he's here to talk a little bit about this theological tradition that came out of our seminary and is certainly a vital part of many churches, both in the United Church of Christ, but in many other denominations as well. Mm-hmm. So welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. I graduated from this wonderful institution in 1979. That means I'm getting older. Hopefully I'm getting wiser. There are some days, however, I feel like I'm just getting older. Who knows anything about the Mercersburg theology? I can tell you anything and get away with it, except I'm being recorded. So now I have to be honest.
Is there a focus on the incarnation?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Very good. Oh, wonderful. Okay, having said that, we can now go to lunch. Yeah, the focus on the incarnation really is the heart of the Mercersburg theology. When I was a student here, I had the great pleasure of studying with George Bricker, who was a walking encyclopedia of the Mercersburg theology. He edited several books along with Chuck Yerrigan, who is recently retired as archivist from Drew University, I believe. Is an adjunct faculty person
right
here?
He teaches the Methodist.
Okay. Well, we shouldn't hold that against him, that he's Methodist. I was Methodist, too. The interesting thing about Mercersburg theology that George Bricker said enough times for us that it finally sank in. The significance for Mercersburg in terms of Christ was ultimately who Christ was and not what Christ did. So everything in Mercersburg theology goes back to the incarnation, that anything that works, works because of who Jesus is. So it starts there with the incarnation. I've never read this anyplace, and so maybe it's the idea for a doctoral thesis. I'm not about to start that now, but you might want to pick up on this. The Mercersburg theology is generally considered an American movement, because it started in Mercersburg. Mercersburg is a little community off of Route 81. It does have an exit that says Mercersburg, and so every time I go south, I genuflect to the sign. It was the site of Marshall College, that eventually came here to Lancaster, with Franklin and Marshall being the result. Mercersburg had money and no students. Lancaster had students and no money, and off we go. The foundation of the seminary at Mercersburg, which really started the whole thing going, was to provide for a trained clergy here in the New World. The Reformed Church that came to America came because of economic reasons and not because of theological reasons. So we have the wave of immigrants that settle in New England come primarily for religious reasons. Thanks to the 30 Years' War and some other rather ugly things in world history that decimated Germany and some surrounding areas, immigrants came to the New World to find literally a new life. And so they brought with them their theology. They were in no way separatists. Most of them came with very little possessions other than a Bible and the Heidelberg Catechism. When they got here, they discovered a wonderful land, but very few clergy. They turned to the Dutch Reformed Church for help because the Dutch Reformed Church had escaped many of the hardships that had plagued more centralized Europe for trained clergy. And the Dutch Church was very generous in training and sending clergy to the New World. But the German Reformed Church really wanted German clergy. And so very early on, the Cetus and the resulting synods of the Reformed Church established a seminary at Kursersberg. One of the early professors that was called there was John Williamson Nevin. John Nevin was not a German Reformed professor. He was Scots-Irish. Came from the seminary in Pittsburgh, but really saw his move from the Presbyterian Church to the Reformed Church as ultimately a change in language only. He was moving from English-speaking Reformed people to German-speaking Reformed people. And this would play into what would develop in certain aspects of the Mercersburg theology. So he arrives at Mercersburg off and running. We are now in the context of American history previous to the Civil War, but the Civil War is starting to rumble. The seminary enjoys some growth requiring another professor. And so the Synod of the Reformed Church sends delegates to Germany to entice a professor to come to join the staff at Mercersburg. Their first choice turned them down. But he said, you know, there's this guy in Berlin named Schaff that you ought to go and talk to. They did. They convinced him to come to the New World. He agreed to it. He was ordained, made a brief stop in England, and eventually came to the New World. His inaugural address was given in German, which many of the people in the German Reformed Church found fascinating. They thought he was speaking in Latin because they didn't speak German anymore. Eventually, it was translated into the principle of Protestantism. If you haven't bumped into that, I just so happen to have some copies of the basic tenets. Eventually, Das Prinzip Protestantismus would be turned into a book. Of course, all good theologians take a speech and turn it into a book. That not only includes a much expanded version of his original text, but also takes the points and numbers them for you, which is great if you're studying for an exam. Remind me to come back to that, especially point 105. Someone write 105 in the margin. What Philip Schaff describes in his inaugural address is a form of Christianity that doesn't sit too well with many in the New World. Philip Schaff was talking about a Christianity that is Catholic in the best sense of the word. In other words, not Roman Catholic, but Catholic meaning universal, and historical. He talks about the Protestant Reformation as being a fruit of the medieval church and not something disconnected from it. This did not sit too well with some of the delegates at the synod, and so begins the Merseburg controversy. And here, I think, is where someone could really excel at a doctoral dissertation. How the Merseburg controversy parallels the tenets of the Civil War in terms of states' rights versus national rights. Because what you see playing out in the Merseburg theology is a discussion about the nature of the church. Is the nature of the church one? Or is the nature of the church churches? In fact, in the discussions that led up to the Union of 1957 that formed the United Church of Christ, there was discussion along the way about what we call this new denomination. Is it the United Church of Christ? Is it the United Churches of Christ? Or something else altogether different? The controversy surrounding Merseburg theology parallels the Civil War, and especially as it follows on the heels of revivalism, as it was sometimes known. What it is sometimes affectionately known as circus tent Christianity. Schaff gives his inaugural address, and Nevin is astounded. Because what Schaff is talking about in terms of the church being Catholic, being organic, and coming out of the very essence of Christ himself, is the conclusion that Nevin had come to already. And so we have this great scholar from Germany coming and essentially reaffirming what Nevin has come to in his thought. And it's like, yes, hooray, we're off and running. Off and running to heresy trial. Schaff would be brought up before the synod on charges of heresy, of trying to make the Reformed Church into a branch of the Roman Catholic Church. Needless to say, Schaff was vindicated, and along the way produced some side benefits for the world of academia, for which I'm sure Anne is greatly responsible. Not responsible. You weren't born then. You are greatly... Well, what's the opposite of responsible?
Irresponsible.
See, here again, we're dealing with English now. The recipient. The recipient. There we
Indeed.
Go.
Indeed.
And that is academic institutions and academic thinking must be free from restraints. Part of the heresy trial of Philip Schaff had to do with the synod's ability to legislate academic thought. And although it's not discussed very much as a result from Schaff's heresy trial, this is one of the fruits, that of academic freedom in research and discussion. So Schaff is vindicated. Nevin has already learned German so that he could navigate in this world. It's wonderful that he's done this, but pretty much unnecessary, because the German Reformed Church had voted to do everything in English. They saw themselves in a new world with a new language and needed to develop that new language in order to be part of the new world and not just be an isolated sect. So everything is now being written in English. One of the needs that the Mercersburg movement saw was a written liturgy. One of the outgrowths of the Mercersburg movement was worship that is liturgical. Not only in that it involves the pastor and the congregation, but that it has some historical context and link with what has gone before, so that we do not reinvent the wheel every time we go to Sunday worship. There is a context of worship. There is a tradition of worship in the best sense of the word tradition. And so they would talk about handing on the faith and not handing down the faith. I'm kind of a weird duck. I love grammar. My wife would say I'm weird in lots of other ways, but we'll just say with the grammar point. But the liturgical worship was a way of expressing the unity of the church. And so the Synod of the Reformed Church appointed a committee to come up with a liturgy. There wasn't too much in place in the New World at that time. Nevin and Schaff, of course, being professors of the seminary, were appointed to serve on this committee. And what they did was to go back through history and look at how worship had developed, and stopping only when they got back as far as the early church. So what they wanted to do was capture the sense of worship that was in the early church and see how that developed as the church developed. Again, this is part of the Mercersburg operating system, of the fact that the church is historical, it's organically related and linked to what has gone before, but the church also develops as it progresses through history. And here my love of grammar will come shining through, in that they were very quick to point out there is a difference between change and develop. The church does not change, but the church does develop. To change means to become something which it was not before. To develop means to grow. And so there was always this sense of how is it that for them, the church in the 1800s is related to the church in the early centuries, and how do we express that in the setting in which we live today? I can tell you a little bit about my journey, just because it's always fun talking about yourself, and I have a captive audience here. I grew up in First Evangelical United Methodist Church in Ephrata, with a theology that was somewhere to the right of Jerry Falwell. When I first encountered Jerry Falwell, I thought he was pretty good for a liberal. My theology changed considerably when I got to college and on to seminary, changed for the better. I was a staunch Calvinist. I went to Messiah College, which is a staunch Anabaptist school, soon to discover that I was one of two Calvinists on campus. So very quickly I discovered I needed to brush up on my theology. When I got to seminary, I was very fortunate to enroll very early on in some critical classes on the New Testament. In college, I was a German major with a minor in Greek. Not only does this idiot like grammar, he likes foreign languages, some of which are a little obscure. When I got to seminary, for the first time in my life, I discovered this thing called a synoptic parallel. I also discovered the term synoptic. And I was forced to look at the Gospels side by side and come to grips with the fact that, no, the Gospels do not always agree. What do you do with that? When one of the Gospels tells you that the women came to the tomb before the sun had risen, one of them says the woman came to the tomb before the sun was risen. Another one says the woman came to the tomb after the sun had come up. How do you deal with that? Well, my theology shifted a bit, but not my appreciation of Scripture. Mercersburg theology, in its day, would have described itself as scientific religion. It was looking at theology in terms of the best resources available to it. And we are pretty much before the modern advent of critical scholarship, but it had already begun. Now that we are hopefully in the middle of critical scholarship, because I think there's still lots more to come, how do you relate that to a theological movement that is now over 100 years old? I think you do that by looking at the basic tenets of a theology. With Mercersburg, it starts with the fact of the incarnation. We start with God becoming human. For Mercersburg, the main question, what is the church, was the driving point. The church goes back to the incarnation. It has an organic relation, a Mercersburg term. We might use a different term today, but I think it's kind of a good term, especially as we become more and more green, to talk about things that are organic and unadulterated. The church must be historical. It doesn't start and stop at convenient points in history. And the church needs to be visible. This was another one of the points of contention as Mercersburg theology develops. Well, you know, we're talking here about the visible and the invisible church, and the invisible church is really where things are happening. Schaff would say, baloney. Who was talking about baloney in Lent? Baloney. The only church you can deal with is the visible church. Jesus says, the church will be here until the end of time. Not floating around in space somewhere, but here in the midst of history. Now, when you look at the basic tenets then of the Mercersburg theology, you'll find that they are as current today as they were in the 1800s. In fact, let me hand around some propaganda. The first part of this is a paper that George Bricker gave. I don't know if it's still still in print. If it isn't in print, I have exercised your privilege under the current copyright laws and made for you one non-commercial copy.
It is available.
We're okay? It is in print? Okay. Then you might want to get an original copy of this. I'm sure if we check in the library and its far-reaching facilities, you'll be able to come up with one. George Bricker here outlines what I've said and does a much better job of it, of course. The other part of the handout are those tenets from the conclusion of the principle of Protestantism. What I'd like you to do is look at point 105. I'm not sure what page it was on. I failed to do that, but since they are numbered sequentially, you should be able to come up with that. I think that's the right one. Would you read that for us?
The two leading nationalities which are continually coming into contact in this country and flowing into one another with reciprocal action are the English and the German.
Schaff is writing this back in the 1800s. What happened in, well, actually in the mid-1800s? What happened in the mid-1900s? World War II. And then, leading up to 1957, how many UCC students? Raise your hand. What happened in 1957? The formation of the United Church of Christ, which came about how?
Congregational Christians and evangelical reform.
Yes, the Congregational Christians tracing their ancestry to what nation?
German. No.
Oh, England, yes. And the Evangelical Reform tracing its ancestry to Germany. What does that say in 105? Yes, even 100 years later, after this was written, we have the influx of influence between Germany and England having an effect on the American church scene. It's still going on. The key with Mercersburg is to think of it not so much as a historical movement as a theological movement. There are those who would look to Mercersburg and describe it as some kind of dusty old history book. For those of us that are practicing Mercersburg, it isn't history, it's life. It is a way of plugging into theology, connecting with the past, and living in the present with the expectation for the future. When I got here to seminary, and through George Bricker was introduced to the Mercersburg theology, all of the disconnected parts of my life came together. It was one of those aha moments, a way of making sense of how can this one person in this place have any kind of relationship to anything that has gone before in the history of the church, or will matter in anything that comes after in the history of the church. It matters because you are a part of it. You are a part in an unbroken history. So that when a church in the early years that has been founded by this or that apostle gets a letter from another apostle named Paul, that letter has authority. Well, we weren't founded by Paul. Why should we listen to him? Because he is part of the same thing that you are. It's something that is being worked out now in the ecumenical movement. And if you want to see development at work, look at the ecumenical movement and see how there has been a development in understanding of just what the ecumenical movement is. COCU, Churches of Christ Uniting. Originally, the acronym stood for
Consultation on Church Union. Mm-hmm.
The name has been modified to reflect a development in understanding of what we're about. Not a great super church, but a recognition that even though we may look a bit different, may do some things a bit differently, we are all part of the same body of Christ. Which is Personsburg in a nutshell. Now I'll stop talking until you ask me a question and I'll start again.
So even if things are done differently, what kind of things might be different?
Well, it could be in the way that a worship service is structured. It could be the language of a worship service. It's interesting if you look at the use of language. Maybe I'm the only one that finds this interesting because of my language bent. But early on in the Orthodox Church, the liturgy was celebrated in the language of the people. It was pretty much the same liturgy, but it was in whatever language was spoken. It wasn't until the Second Vatican Council that English, for the Roman Catholic Church, was a language that God understood. Maintaining the East-West orientation. The West has, in the Roman Catholic Church, a pope. In the East, there is no Orthodox pope. There is a council of bishops, in which there is no first among equals, which is kind of an oxymoron. Language is just one example. But you have such distinctions even in the early church. The discussion about can you eat bologna in Lent? A discussion in Paul's writings, you know, do you eat meat offered to an idol? If you know the idol is made out of stone or wood, it doesn't matter. But if someone hasn't arrived at that conclusion yet and you might infringe upon their developing faith, it's something you need to watch out for.
like the high, low, Merseburg, or sinus. And one of the comments that I heard was that when you look at our hidden histories, well, we know which one won out. Well, I see that there was a growth within even the Merseburg, that, as well as our sinus, that they, parts of it still, they grew, and I don't know that I see it as really a win out or growing and understanding together. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, our sinus comes about primarily because of the Merseburg controversy, where the Philadelphia classes and some of the high power clergy there said, well, you know, fine, you can do that, we're going to do this. The Merseburg theology and winning out, oftentimes you draw that conclusion by looking at the liturgical progress. However, the provisional liturgy of 1857, the order of 1866, which is known as the Merseburg liturgy, and everything else that followed from the Evangelical and Reformed Church, from the Reformed Church of the United States into the Evangelical and Reformed Church, was offered to the church for their use, but was never mandated. So, for the Merseburg churches, it becomes, well, thank you, we have the resource that we want, this is how we're doing it. For the non-Merseburg churches, it was a resource that they could use, pick from, and so forth. Bless you. When the United Church of Christ publishes Book of Worship, and notice it is not the Book of Worship, it is just Book of Worship. It is continuing that trend, that tradition, established under the Merseburg reign, of producing liturgical materials, but not making them mandatory. If you look at some other denominations, that isn't the case. If you look at the Book of Common Prayer, it is the Book of Common Prayer. You have various forms and rites in there, 1 and 2, A and B. But that's not how Merseburg wanted to see liturgical work develop. It cannot be mandated. It can be offered. If you want to use it, here it is. Merseburg always understood itself to be an expression, but not the expression. Because one of the other issues that was going on at the time is the whole question of the sect, S-E-C-T, where you become cut off and you become your own little isolated thing. And in one of the writings, it was said, you know, if we had the authority to eliminate everything else and be the church, we wouldn't do it, because then we would be the sect. So the development here between high and low in the Reformed Church is kind of interesting. Merseburg may have won out in producing the liturgies, but Ursinus probably won out in terms of ignoring them.
Okay.
But again, Merseburg wanted to have this material available for your use, but not mandating it.
I think at St. Luke's, which was like one of the major churches behind the Ursinus movement, now would be really, when you see it in that, it's very Merseburg.
Yeah. It's interesting how things tumble along in history. New Brunswick Seminary in Jersey is, of course, RCA Seminary. And some of the proponents of the heresy trial would leave the German Reformed Church and go to the Dutch Reformed Church. Berg and Bomberg being...
Yeah, at that same time we had the discussion about merging with the...
With the Dutch, Reformed. It's interesting, there are several of the German Reformed who left the German Reformed for the Dutch Reformed Church. And for a while, the president of the Mercersburg Society was the president of New Brunswick Seminary, Howard Hageman, which was the driving force behind the RCA hymnal and was instrumental in getting a sense of a structured liturgy for the RCA church. So it was funny how we met in his home and at the seminary quite frequently to be sitting in the institution that benefited from those leaving the Mercersburg Society, Mercersburg Theology, and now was contributing to the Mercersburg Theology. I guess we could talk about that in terms of the developmental model.
Developmental versus the change.
I could probably promote our convocation, which is coming up in June.
That's also interesting, the connection with Andover Newton being congregational. Was it a couple years ago you met up there and a couple of the professors?
Well, Andover Newton is kind of interesting in its own rights as being United Church of Christ and American Baptist. It probably makes about as much sense as the Congregational Christians and the Evangelical and Reformed getting together. Every year we have a convocation where we look at Mercersburg theology in contemporary expression. This year we're looking at sight and sound, not the thing down here in Strasbourg, but how Mercersburg theology gets played out in the church. I think one of the most important portions of this event this year will be the workshop that I'm doing. In my parish, we have developed an Easter and a Christian... what's that other event? Christmas. Christmas is... we essentially have High Mass for Easter and Christmas. We sing the service. Not using chant, but using popular hymn tunes. And we're presenting that as a way of doing Mercersburg theology in its present context. We see that as a way of furthering the one point of Mercersburg theology in the sense of that worship is liturgical. It involves the whole congregation. And a church generally loves to sing if it knows the melody. So we use very familiar melodies and off we go. The convocation moves around the Northeast. We have been in Baltimore. We had one of our morning prayers in the Basilica in Baltimore. My wife participated in that, which was an experience for her. She grew up Roman Catholic and wasn't ever allowed to go up into the chancel, and there she was, and that was interesting. We've been to Massachusetts several times. We've been in Mercersburg itself. There is a beautiful Gothic church there that was built after the seminary left. Excuse me, I must be getting close to the end of my time for talking because I'm losing my voice. It looks like it's going to be a pretty good meeting. We're in New Goshenhoppen, which is off of the northeast extension of the Turnpike. If you think you're interested in going, I have hotel information there. The best thing to do is to call them and not use the internet. We've been able to secure some really good rates, but they're only valid if you call and tell them, I have a really good rate. Because if you use the website for the hotel doesn't know about the good rate. One of the other wonderful things we have, is this the yellow paper?
Yes.
Is the prize for Mercer's Bird Theology, which comes with a stipend of $750. Wow, that's almost enough to go out and eat lunch.
Well, it's more.
But Anne, do you want to talk to that a minute and let me get my voice back?
Sure. The Society sponsors this prize. Every year we receive submissions, papers in Mercersburg Theology on any topic. And it can be something that you write in a course, like your Christianity in America course, or if you're taking Mercersburg Theology next year.
Wonder science is Christianity in America.
And the winner of this is actually, last year's winner is one of the presenters at this year's conference. He presented a paper on Mercersburg and architecture, how churches that adopted a Mercersburg approach to worship then redesigned their sanctuaries in light of that. But we've had papers on the theology of the Eucharist. We've had papers on a whole variety of features of this. So if it's a topic that interests you in pursuing, you can certainly write a paper this spring and submit it, or think about it for next year. This is an annual prize. So.
Are they still being published in the New Mercersburg Review?
At the discretion of the editor.
At the
What?
Who's the editor?
Right now, Chris Anderson, who's the pastor at Heidelberg UCC in New York, is taking care of that. So if you win, you get to present your paper at the next convocation, and it may be published as well. And if you have any more questions about that, I'm happy to receive them.